ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts.
Hey guys, it's Pablo. Not to go all masterpiece theater on you here, but I did want to break the fourth wall to tell you how much I enjoy this episode. It is all about the Badwater Ultra Marathon, otherwise known as the most insane foot race on this planet. It is 135 miles long. It goes through the desert, through the mountains, and it was completed by our good friend, Colleen Conahan, who just so happened to take a microphone with her. So today, we're taking you through the world's most impossible run all over again. It is one of our favorites. So enjoy. It is Monday, February 21st. This is ESPN Daily.
In ultra marathons, it's crazy. I don't go into it with anything in my mind of like, this is what's going to get me through. But these mantras just find you. They just do. And this one, in this case, was find it.
That's Colleen Conahan telling me what it's like to run 135 miles across the desert and how she found a way to keep going.
It was the first section where I really felt groggy. So it was overnight. It was kind of early in the race. I was like 22 miles in and, you know, 5 hours in. I should have still been feeling fresh, but it just hit me like a wave, right? I was just so tired all of a sudden. And the words just came to me, find it. And I didn't know exactly what it meant.
I mean, yeah. I don't know what happened. Like, 155. I've run 28, 29 miles. And for a while, I was crazy, like feeling so groggy. And something just happened and I feel great again.
But I knew that it was just whatever you need to find in this moment.
And this is such a good reminder early in this race that when I'm feeling horrible, there's a second life on the other side of that. That just happens. Like, you really, really just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other. You just have to keep pushing because there's something there if you do that. And there are not a lot of sports that have this level of exertion where you can just be tank on empty.
And I just kept coming to that throughout the race, find it. And there's something really cathartic in those words, right? It's just two words. It's six letters. It's so simple. But it was also about a purpose, right? Why am I doing this? Why was I bothering to go through something so grueling? Why was I putting myself through this? What was it that I was looking for the whole time?
So, Colleen, full disclosure here. We know each other. Like, we've been friends for a long time.
We do know each other.
For years and years now, and I knew you to be a person who runs ultra marathons. Your writing about your Badwater experience really has made me both terrified and excited to talk to you here today.
I mean, it's the experience of a lifetime.
Colleen Conahan ran the Badwater Ultra Marathon in July of this year and wrote about her experience for ESPN.com.
And honestly, talking about it is the best way for me to uncover even more of what happened to me out there.
Yeah, I wouldn't call Badwater a safe space. Let's start there, right? Because the term ultra marathon, Colleen, like, I knew that it is any race that's longer than the regular marathon, which is 26.2 miles. But Badwater, just to be very clear here, is more than five times that long. It's five marathons, approximately. Is that the distance of it?
Yeah, it's 135 miles. And honestly, I try not to think about it that way, but there's no way you can take one bite out of it. So it's hard to even think about it in however many marathons, because each one of those is grueling in their own rights. But it does not compare to the 20,000 feet of elevation gain and loss that happens over the course of, you know, what took me 37 hours to complete. You have to worry about fatigue and sleep deprivation, and, you know, chafing and all of the things that would, you know, that ultimately not only make you slower from a, you know, muscular and output perspective, but also things that you actually have to do to be able to, like, biologically function over that period of time.
Yeah, so look, bad water sounds like a euphemism for a terrible thing. It is also literally a place. So just set the scene for us here. Like, where is this? Give us a topographical sort of rundown here.
Sure. Badwater Basin is the lowest point in North America. It is part of Death Valley. It is an apocalyptic landscape. There's a series of mountains that surround it, and it is actually, it's a basin. So there's actually a salt flat that exists in Badwater Basin. And because it's at the bottom of this kind of cavernous set of mountains, it's surrounded on all sides. The wind just really like whips around in there. And it's almost like a, you know, it's a convex shape. So the heat stays trapped down there. And so it sincerely feels like you're standing under a hairdryer. And that's where the race starts, is at this, you know, the lowest point in North America. So the minute that you start, you are just climbing, right?
God is blasting you with his hairdryer at the beginning. Or maybe 100%. The devil is. Maybe the devil is blasting you with his hairdryer. And then where does it go from there?
So that from there, you essentially cross all of Death Valley. You run through the entire national park. So you start climbing. Basically, you are a steady 1% grade hill, which doesn't seem so much until you realize you're doing it for about, roughly 17 miles straight. Just straight uphill. And I'll tell you this, it is gorgeous. So, I mean, if you've never been to Death Valley, it is not just a tumbleweed desert. There are these beautiful mountain structures all over the place. And it feels like you're on Mars. It is gorgeous. But I'll tell you, it's pretty difficult to appreciate it when you are so exhausted, your feet are blistered, your back is chafing.
I just want to point this out. Like, your tone in your description here, like, it's remarkably casual how you're describing crossing Death Valley.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely sapped me of my soul. So maybe I'm looking back with rose-colored glasses on this experience.
I mean, Kalane, running is in your soul, right? I mean, you've done all of these regular, quote-unquote, marathons before. You've done a couple of other ultra-marathons before, the sort of, quote-unquote, normal 100-mile races before you decided to try Badwater. And Badwater, I know you got to know by working as part of the support crew for a friend of yours named Mozzie, who tried to run it in 2018 and did not finish. And then again in 2019, and he did, and you were there for both of those attempts. So you saw how risky, how punishing this particular race could be. You knew this would be an event where quitting and failure, those are more than theoretical concepts. So how did you go about training for this?
So there are at least three ways that you train that I'm aware of. There's the mental preparation, and then there's heat training. So when you get into the running, no surprise, when you're running ultramarathons, you've got to put on a lot of miles. So I was at a place where, you know, I routinely, even in my kind of off season, as it were, I try to keep somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 60 miles a week. But when I was training for Badwater, I knew I had to ramp up. You need to get your legs comfortable with fatigue and understanding how to kind of find more power and to grow those muscles so that they are able to carry you for an even further distance, even when you are totally gassed. And so to do that, I was running, I worked myself up to 85 to 100 mile a week. Whether it was doing 5 days a week or 6 days a week with a little bit shorter and one day of rest. But that was always really important to me, was to make sure that I was resting my body so that I could come back the next week and either build on whatever mileage number I had done for the week. And I think that building up in a gradual, progressive way to that actually gives you that insight into what your body is actually telling you. So heat training.
Yeah. So the heat training, I grew uncomfortable just reading about this.
So about 5 weeks out from the race, what you're trying to do is spend as much time at high temperatures as you can possibly tolerate. And so there's a few things that I did. The first one is when I was doing my long runs, or any of my runs, frankly, I was layering up. So it was 90-something degrees here in D.C.
I'm sweating recalling my visits to D.C. in the summertime. The humidity, the sheer swamp escalade, as the scientists would call it.
I mean, you said it, not me. But yeah, I mean, it is so humid here, but I would be wearing at least 3 layers on top. I would typically be wearing sweatpants and long socks. I would occasionally treat myself to wearing shorts. But yeah, so I would run however many miles in multiple layers, often with a ski hat on, occasionally with gloves on. And I mean, let me tell you, running around the District of Columbia wearing something that could conceal, I don't know, anything, it's already kind of a little dicey. I did actually see Elizabeth Warren on one of my runs one morning, and I was like, I hope she doesn't think that I'm a threat of any kind. But yeah, you look like a total psychopath, but you got to do it. I mean, I was doing laundry as if I was, a sorority house. It was insanity. There were so many clothes every single day in my hamper. I also was doing heat training in 2 other ways. The first one was in a sauna. So I would go to the gym and I would get into the sauna and spend an hour in there. The first time that I did it, I was so proud. I walked in, it was 180 degrees, and I was like, all right, let's do this, lock it in, 60 minutes, go. And so, I'm there with my book and I've got water and I'm sitting on a towel and I'm just drenched and I, make it the full hour. I'm so pleased with myself. 2 days later, I do the same thing and I couldn't make it past 30. I got to 30 minutes and I was like, my heart is racing. I'm not doing anything. I'm just sitting here. I, pushed myself to 40 minutes or maybe 42 minutes and I stepped out. I cooled off. I, toweled off a little bit. I refilled my water bottle and I went back in because I was dedicated to getting to 60 minutes. And then I finally looked at the thermometer inside the sauna and I was like, oh, because it read 200 degrees.
Oh,
so I was just, I was just basically, I was roasting.
Yeah, you were becoming a turducken. Yes.
Exactly. So yeah, so that obviously takes a lot of mental tenacity to just sit somewhere as you roast and roast and roast. And then the third place that heat training takes place.
I cannot believe there is still a third place in this regimen.
Well, I mean, it just never ends, to be honest with you. So, you bring it home with you. Ultra running is not a casual hobby where, it stops when you take your shoes off, unfortunately. And so I brought the great privilege of heat training back to my home where we did not have air conditioning on throughout the entire summer here in the District of Columbia. Ugh. And so it was a spicy 84 in our house pretty much at all times. I was just a disgusting sweatball. But I think in the end, it's so essential because otherwise, I mean, that's the biggest risk, I think, at Badwater of not succeeding is if your body can't take the heat, not just dehydrated, but experiencing some kind of organ failure. Your kidneys are very important. And so you got to make sure that they don't shut down on your quest to complete Badwater.
Yeah. Wait, just to give me the range of temperatures in Badwater again. Like how hot are we talking?
So when I started, it was 8 p.m. And at 8 p.m., it was 113 degrees. And so that was the start of the race. It cooled overnight to about 101. And then, you kick back up. As soon as the sun comes back out, roaring and raging, it really starts to kick up again. If you're on the road, which is black, it continues to bake and bake and it just retains heat and just keeps attracting the sun. So it is way hotter on the actual pavement. And it's just cooking you from the bottom up. There is a section of the race after I climbed out of the second mountain section, you experience a series of flats and you're out, you've essentially cleared Death Valley, but it was still over 100 degrees. So it was 107 degrees and I felt cool. So I had asked my crew chief, Ricky Haro. I was like, Ricky, can I please take this ice bandana off? It was, you know, tied around my neck, filled with ice. It was heavy. It was chafing me. All the water was dripping. I was soaking wet. And I was just like, can I please take this off? And he was like, girl, it's 107 degrees. Like, keep it on. No, you can't. You cannot take that off. Then subsequently, once you fully clear Death Valley and kind of like the desert area, you're moving into the third section of the race towards Mount Whitney, which is the final climb. It actually gets into the 70s. And so that, I mean, you're talking about a 40 degree difference from the start of the race. I was wearing a sweatshirt. I was freezing. I couldn't believe how cold I felt because I was just so used to running in such hot temperatures.
All right. So we have the lay of the land now. We have a sense of the climate. But after the break, Kalane, I want to dive into a natural disaster that you encountered and the people who helped you survive all of it.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Kalane, you ran all these experiments on yourself, basically, and you showed up at the starting line in the truly extreme heat of July with about 100 runners in total, starting between 8 p.m. and 11 p.m., all of which is already totally different from a typical race. So, just like your headspace in the actual doing of this, what was that like?
It's bizarre. It's a total mind, like a total mind. I don't even know how to say it without saying mind.
I think you're allowed like, to. Kalane, if you run an ultra marathon, if you run Badwater, you can say mind on ESPN Daily.
Yeah, I think I have to because, I mean, there are so many layers of mind that just come at you from every angle. Something that I think is a really interesting fact that, you know, my cousin found it on the internet. More people have summited Mount Everest than have ever done Badwater.
And yes, ESPN Daily has confirmed the veracity of this fact.
And so I was super honored to be one of them. And yeah, I mean, from the outset, when you get started, the first 17 miles are supposed to be the easiest, flattest, kind of least strenuous section because you're starting fresh, right? You're ready to go. You're probably super excited. It was supposed to be like these slow, easy miles. But unfortunately, in this case, right, there was a natural disaster that it sincerely felt like I was being pulled backwards by resistance bands. Well, in my case, unfortunately, I was running into what's called a haboob.
Well, explain for those uninitiated what a haboob is.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I was uninitiated until I ran into one. We were driving to the start line and Ricky, who lives in Phoenix, he was like, oh, you're going to be running into a haboob. And I was like, great. What is that? What is
that,
a haboob?
That does sound like a Star Wars character now that you mention it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I honestly didn't know what he was talking about in his frame of reference. He's like, have you ever seen The Mummy? And I was like, oh, terrific. I mean, that's perfect. Just what I dreamed of, you know, running straight into this dust storm. Basically, a haboob happens after there's been some other storm or weather in the area. And so there had been a thunderstorm the day prior, which kicked up a bunch of dust, as you can imagine. There's a ton of dust and sand in any desert. And when it rains so seldom, it kind of puffs up and turns into a cloud of debris, of dust. And because in Death Valley, like I mentioned earlier, the air just circulates. So it's just kind of spinning and whirling around. It created this entire wall of dust, just this dust cloud, you know, heading straight towards us.
I've been walking for 8 miles basically directly into a headwind, which you can probably hear.
And so, I mean, we ran, every single runner ran through a massive haboob for 17 miles directly in our face.
It's 9:34, so it's been an hour and 4 minutes since the race started, and this wind has just not subsided. I have no idea how aggressive it is, like, I don't know what the speed is, but it's pretty insane.
I can't even form words to tell you how challenging it was, because I'd never even heard of it before. And all of a sudden it was like, here's your first challenge. Go. All I have access to are a pair of sunglasses, which, as you know, as the sun goes down, you don't really want them, but I'm just using them to protect. Like, I wear contact lenses, and I was so worried they were going to dry out that I was wearing sunglasses at night. Corey Hart would have been very proud of me. I didn't have any supplies to, like, help fend it off. There's really nothing that you can do that stands between you and a natural disaster you've never even heard of.
Presumably, you know, you survive the death storm, death sandstorm. What are you subsisting on?
I think a lot of people suspect that these, you know, very skinny, very fit ultra runners probably run on, you know, vegan treats and,
yes,
you know, and wishes and, you know, just good vibes.
Yeah. Very organic vibes. Yeah.
100%. That's what people think. It is quite the opposite. So you will, if you ever go to an ultra marathon, the number one life-saving device is Coca-Cola. It is, it is an elixir of the gods. I mean, every ultra runner worth his or her or their salt is drinking Coca-Cola. Flat Coke will propel you into places that you never thought possible. Especially at Badwater, you know, your body is so focused on keeping you cool that it can't digest anything complicated. So it's the simplest white bread, white sugar, you know, bad garbage that you could possibly put in your body. So I ate a ton of Pop-Tarts. I had a lot of, like, gummy candy.
You're eating like a decadent fourth grade.
Yeah, I absolutely. Another very common treat is pickles. You need salt, and you need those electrolytes. And I'll be honest, I don't love super sugary things. I don't drink Coke in my regular life. So at a certain point, you are just so sick of everything sweet that, like, cutting it with pickles is a game changer. Also, ramen is a godsend.
I want to amend my description to a very decadent and stoned fourth grader.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's like, I think in general, in my regular life, I eat pretty healthy. But these 48 hours were, you know, worse than college for sure.
So you're making your way, and I know you have the support team with you, and they're the purveyor of these snacks. There's more to it, though, right? The dynamic between you guys. How do you even begin to describe what that's like?
I mean, your support crew is your lifeline. I can't imagine even starting a race without the people that I had there. There's no way that I would have succeeded. There's no way I would have successfully crossed Death Valley without my crew. They are essential. And you need them to be locked in and understand what the mission is and to push you. So they are your motivational party. They are looking out for your vital signs, right? You know, I felt like a proud 4-year-old. Every time that I peed, I had to tell them, right? Because that is one of the warning signs. If you're going to be, if you're going to be experiencing organ failure, right? Like, if you haven't peed for several hours. So, like, I'd be like, hey guys, I peed. And, you know, it was like a very, yay, we did it. They were really, you know, my eyes and ears in a lot of ways. And you got to trust them. You know, my crew chief, Ricky Haro, like, I worked with him when I crewed Masi originally. And this guy is just, he is the most incredible person. I mean, he himself, Pablo, has done 2 crossings of Death Valley, not during Badwater. One of them was just like with his own private crew, you know, just self-motivated
just
by himself.
For the love of the game.
Exactly. Love of the game. So I couldn't feel more comfortable than being in Ricky's very capable hands. He's seen it all. He's felt it all. He's experienced it all. And that's exactly who you want to be in charge of your crew. The other three people had never crewed before. So my friend Jimmy Wilborn, who I've known since 2013, we run races together on like a relay team. He knows how to motivate me in a way just by like trash talking me and making sure that my like head is in the game. But he's fun. He's like a really good energy. And then the other two members of my crew actually had never met before, Brenna Bray and Kaylee Demersian. And the two of them, you know, I wanted to have women on my team because they're, despite the race director's efforts to get more women to participate at Badwater, they tend to apply in fewer numbers. But I will have you know that they succeed. They finish at a much higher rate than the men do. So ladies, if you're out there and you're looking to dip a toe in, just know that you already have a great track record behind you of people who don't quit. But Kaylee and Brenna, basically Ricky had known each of them in a different context. And I am so grateful that, you know, not only were they locked in and understanding everything that was happening with me, you know, biologically, biophysically, mechanically, you know, when my knee was hurting or when my toes were hurting or when I was blistered, you know, fixing any chafing or blisters that appeared. But they also kept my spirits going, despite the way that I treated them at some times. You know, I went to a really dark place a few times.
Yeah, wait. So wait, you kind of tried to sneak it in there, though. How did you treat them at your worst, Colleen? What does that sound like?
Well, I mean, I'm not proud of it. I think I run a little hot.
In every sense, you clearly run a little hot. Yeah.
So I like to say that I have two modes. I have happy and angry. And so just as an example, there the section of Panamint Valley, where it is a 7-mile stretch of extremely hot, baking, flat road. You can see where you're going to stop. You know where the checkpoint is. I knew I was going down for a nap at that moment. And I was so hot. My legs were literally swirled with little, it was not sunburn. It's like flash heating. So these little red swirls were appearing on my legs because they were just so hot. And I was so tired, right? It was 1 p.m. on the second day. So I'd already been awake for over 24 hours and I had gone, you know, 68 miles, let's call it. And I thought I had a mile left to get to the checkpoint. And then I looked up and saw a sign that said that the checkpoint was 3 miles away and I lost it. I just was so angry. I could not believe, you know, like my eyes deceived me. And so I'm like huffing and puffing and Jimmy was actually, he was running the miles with me at the time and spraying me down with water. And he ran across to the van to like get refueled, to restock on supplies and to come back to me. And I was just like, I know one of these people is going to say something nice to me. They're going to try to encourage me. And I was like, I got to get ahead of this because I do not have the patience for someone to patronize me right now, not on my watch. And so I'm full head of steam and I'm walking past the van. I'm just like power hiking. And I just scream at them. I'm like, no one better tell me I'm doing a good job right now. And I mean, all of them just slack jawed, eyes bugging, like just dead silence. And I just kept marching. Luckily, you know, I think that was really that was my baptism. That was my Badwater baptism. That was the moment that I became someone else. I'm not proud of who I became, right? I'm yelling at these amazing people who have taken a week of their time to make sure that I succeed at my own goal. But I just, like, I didn't have another mode at the time, right? I didn't have the ability to kind of dampen my emotional outburst and how frustrated I was.
So, Colleen, you know, I have to ask this question that I know you're not going to like. And since I think I know that you don't like it, I want to ask it a different way, kind of. So why do you hate it when people ask why you do something as punishing as running Badwater?
Oh, God, I do. It's crazy. I hate it. And everyone asks, right? I mean, I just feel like to me, it's so self-evident that I'm like, don't you have this too? Like, don't you have this mode where you're just trying to do something exceptional or extraordinary or better than you are? Like, it's crazy that to me that it, like, that people don't have this mode. And so I think so many of them, when they ask the question, they do it in a way that's almost accusatory, right? They're like, oh, why? Like, why would you ever do this? And, you know, to me, it's like, well, sorry for your lack of imagination, but this this world exists out here and I'm just trying to experience it. I feel like they're challenging me to get me to like dial back or do less. And maybe that's just a chip on my shoulder. You know, when people ask me why, I'm like, what's your why? Why don't you? Like, where are you at? Like, everybody's got you. Don't you burn for something? Isn't there anything that like makes you want to just get out there and do something ridiculous and stupid and painful and at the same time that will absolutely change your whole worldview? Because that's what this is to me.
Okay, after this break, Kalain, I want to understand how your worldview changed and exactly what you learned.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine. Especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
I love that part of your secret recipe here, Kalain, is just this sort of ability to out-effort people and also Whitney Houston.
Yeah, man. I love music and I typically do my runs, you know, my training runs, I'll do them with, you know, some mix of podcasts. I'll be honest, the daily is literally an every single morning listen. So thank you all for propelling many, many of my runs.
But Whitney is that's the button that you press when you need something, right?
This was when I was feeling particularly, you know, down and out. I had tried everything. I already drank my magic elixir of Coke. I had a bunch of candy and I was kind of solo dolo. There was no one around. I couldn't see another person for miles. It was pitch black. It was just me and my headlamp. And then I asked for my headphones and there was Whitney, yet another scrappy girl from New Jersey, propelling me. It woke me up. It shook me to my core. And I just started singing. Like, I did not give a single F. Like, I was just out loud to the mountains, no one around, singing my head off. It totally changed the game for me. Like, that was the first thing when I said, find it. The answer was Whitney Houston. I found Whitney. Or maybe she found me.
So, Kalain, the middle part of this race, that's Town Pass going into Panamint Valley, like the halfway point. Like, what did it take to get there? Tell me about that part of this.
Yeah. Town Pass is basically when you're like climbing. You climb up Town Pass and then you like descend into these manic switchbacks that are crazy and you just are flying. You're going faster than you go the whole race. Like, I was running 8-minute miles during that section. Which is hard because you don't want to burn yourself out. And so you got to just like dial it back and be pretty restrained. But that leads you right to Panamint Valley, which is the next checkpoint. And at that point, I had been running all the way through the night. It was fully on the high heat of the day. And I don't think I was mentally prepared for how hot and terrible it was going to be to cross just 7 miles, right? In my head, a 7 mile section that is flat should be really straightforward. I mean, I was being pelted by the sun and I was so overtired. I've never been in such an angry headspace. I was mad at myself. I was mad at my crew. They did nothing wrong. They were angels. But I was like, I hate these people. I want everything to stop. I hate myself. Why have I made these choices?
Well, Colleen, how close did you come at any point in the race to like stopping?
Like quitting stopping?
Yeah.
Zero. Never, literally never. There was not one, and it's crazy. Like I wanted to stop and I did, right? I took 2 30-minute naps and 1 4-minute nap. I promise you that 4-minute nap changed my life. But there was never a single time that I was like, I can't do this. I set out to do this and I'm going to freaking do it, come literal hell or high water, or in this case, a haboob. And my crew being so dialed in, knowing exactly what to do for, including receiving my ire and anger and just the ferocity of like my New Jersey, you know, what's the matter with you? That was coming out at, you know, at full throttle.
Yeah, your primal jersey. Yeah, yeah. It's hard to,
that is
hard,
exactly
hard to
the term.
That.
My yeah. primal jersey that just was flying out of my pores like it was sweat. I had done the work and I wanted to prove to myself that I had it within me to do something exceptional. Ultra running is the ultimate effort sport and that's who I am. I'm not going to quit when I still have anything left in the can.
Colleen, the fact that you did all of this despite the chafing. Can we talk about the chafing? I feel like the chafing is not a thing that we've talked about enough at this point in the podcast.
I mean, I feel a raw sensation just thinking about it. The chafing is unlike any I've experienced. And like, I mean, I run marathons and ultra marathons. I train 12 months a year. Like I've felt chafing before, but it does not compare to the chafing that I felt during bad water. There's obviously you're sweating more than you usually do, right? So you're constant. There is the friction is everywhere. And so, I mean, whether that's your body against your body, right? Like your butt cheeks. But in my case, like a lot of it was also just, I mean, my sports bra just like tore me to pieces.
Mm.
And there's nothing you can do. It is a nightmare.
Chafing, Colleen. The chafing wants you to quit. That's what it wants you to do.
I mean, the chafing is, it might be the top boss, right? Like it may be the
top of the Mortal Kombat totem pole is chafing.
Is chafing, yes. Right? And it seems like it's such a minor threat, but no, I mean, it will not stop until you do. The ultra running community is unlike anything I've experienced. So the most humble, benevolent, wonderful people, because I mean, you're going to, at some point, we're all going to eat shit. Like that's just the way that it is. You're going to, and I think that humility just grows as a part of these, you know, hardwired competitive people, right? It's not just your speed or your pace. It's what obstacles did you face between here and there? How did you overcome them? How did you solve those problems? And so there is that kinship that you mentioned. There is a sense of we've all been through this and battled our own demons and figured and crossed our own Panamint valleys. And what was it like for you? Because for me, I had to face myself. I had to face the chafing, but maybe you didn't. And maybe you had something that was worse.
And I imagine, Colleen, that it is the internal that bonds people like this, forms that fellowship, but it also has to be the external, right? Just the beauty of this experience.
I mean, absolutely. Death Valley is an absolutely beautiful, astounding place. It is unlike anywhere I've been on Earth. People don't live in Death Valley. And so when it goes dark, it is pitch black. You can see the Milky Way. Just this uninterrupted view of the universe, and you feel small, but in a very wonderful way.
So I just stopped to pee, and it's like the first time I've looked off in a while, and I just noticed how absolutely pitch black it is and how you can see every star possible, including the Milky Way. And it is just absolutely magnificent. What a night.
That last climb up Mount Whitney, I mean, it's breathtaking. And to be able to cap off your race with an uphill climb, literally the last 13 miles are all uphill. And so it's brutal. But occasionally, if you just turn around and you look back, you see every step that you've covered on your own 2 feet. And you look back at this beautiful valley beneath you and these rolling hills beneath you. And those are the moments when you realize, like, I'm a part of this tradition, this Badwater tradition, seeing the ugly side of yourself, seeing the ugly side of the desert. You're one with nature. You are primal. You are disgusting. you are everything. And you realize that you are just an animal in nature. It's crazy.
And that's why I want to know, like, what did you expect finishing this race to feel like? And what did it actually feel like when you got there?
Yeah, I mean, I expected to be triumphant, right? I expected to be fist pumping and high-fiving and maybe crying. And I was really kind of taken aback. It was almost anticlimactic when I finished. I had nothing left in me. And I barely remember finishing, to be honest. And then it wasn't until later that evening that I really, you know, after I took a nap and a shower and became a human again, that I really started to unpack how I felt about the whole experience. I mean, this writing this piece was a really big step forward and really helpful in helping me understand what I did and what it means to me. But there's still so much more that I've learned about myself, that I felt about my crew, and that I feel about myself as an athlete, as an ultra runner, and even just as a person in society. You can't possibly do something with such magnitude and expect to be the same person afterwards. And I'm so grateful.
Colleen Conahan, thank you for thinking about it. Thank you for finding it on ESPN Daily.
This was a pleasure, Pablo. I'm so happy to have shared with you.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.